they had conditions where they gave people no protein, 25 grams of protein, or 100 grams of protein, which is a pretty substantial amount of protein. And they found that actually the 100 gram response was higher in terms of what it did for muscle than the 25 gram response. And it was sustained over a very long period of time. So, you know, that sort of bucks the answer that I would have given prior to that paper.
Hello there, and welcome to Muscle for Life. I am Mike Matthews. Thank you for joining me today for a new episode on the topic of protein intake. And this is a perennial topic, one that will probably always be a matter of curiosity and contention. In the 10 years or so that I've been in the fitness industry, I've been regularly asked the same handful of questions all the way up until today, like, how much protein should I be eating to maximize muscle growth? Is it 0.8 grams per pound of body weight per day? Is it 1 gram? Is it more than 1 gram? How much protein can the body digest and absorb in one sitting? And if you eat more than that, is the excess protein disposed of, or is it stored for later use, or does something else happen? Is there an upper limit on muscle protein synthesis? So maybe the limit is not digestion and absorption, but it is the rate at which the body's muscle building machinery can work. And does a certain amount of protein maximally stimulate that? And if you eat more protein than that amount, is the excess, again, disposed of, stored, something else? Protein timing, that's another common question. Does it really matter when you eat protein, how often you eat protein, how you break up your total daily protein intake into separate meals? For example, can you eat just one or two large servings of protein every day and gain just as much muscle and strength as five smaller servings throughout the day? Well, in today's episode, we are going to explore those questions and get evidence-based answers. And you are going to be hearing mostly from my guest, Dr. Stuart Phillips, who is a world-renowned protein researcher with more than 450 published peer-reviewed articles. Dr. Phillips really is a bona fide protein metabolism guru. And in this episode, he is going to talk about how much protein your body can use in one meal. He's going to comment specifically on a new study that a lot of people have been talking about that is challenging the common belief that there is a limit to how much protein your body can use in one meal. And then Dr. Phillips is going to talk about the role of protein as you age. He talks about the anabolic window, the first meal effect, and more. Do you sometimes lack the energy and the motivation to get into the gym? Do you sometimes want to hit the snooze button instead of the squat rack? And are you sometimes just not able to give 100% in your workouts? If so, my pre-workout Pulse is for you. It is a 100% natural supplement that increases energy, improves mood and sharpens mental focus, increases strength and endurance, and reduces fatigue. And the reason it's so effective is simple. Every ingredient in Pulse is backed by peer-reviewed scientific research and is included at clinically effective levels, the exact amounts used in the studies that found benefits. Pulse is also naturally sweetened and flavored, and it contains no artificial food dyes or other chemical junk. And all that is why I've sold over 850,000 bottles of Pulse and why it has over 11,000 4 and 5 star reviews on Amazon and on my website. So if you want some help getting fired up, zeroed in, and ready to crush your workouts, then you want to try Pulse today. Go to buylegion.com, that is buylegion.com/pulse, and use the coupon code MUSCLE at checkout, and you will save 20% on your entire order if it's your first order with us. And if it's not your first order, you will get double reward points on the entire order, and that is 6% cash back instead of the normal 3% cash back that you get from our reward program. And know that if you don't absolutely love Pulse, just let us know and we will give you a full refund on the spot. No forms, no return even is necessary. So you can't lose. Go to buylegion.com/pulse, order now, use the coupon code muscle, save 20%, try Pulse risk-free and see what you think.
Hey, Stu, it's nice to meet you.
Thanks for having me on the show, Mike. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us about protein metabolism, which sounds maybe a little bit boring to some listeners, but it's going to be informative and it's going to be practical. And just to tee it up, so most of the listeners, they know that it's important to eat a fair amount of protein, to eat a high protein diet to maximize muscle and strength gain, or even just to support body composition. They understand that. And most people listening probably understand that the most important factor in protein intake is just total protein intake. They know that first and foremost, you just have to make sure you eat enough every day on average. You can have some days higher, some days lower, but on average, eat enough, regardless of how you get there, and you're going to do fine. However, many people ask things like, well, I heard that you can only absorb so much protein in one meal. I remember, 10 years ago when I got into the fitness racket, that was a matter of controversy then, and it still is now. And from what I've seen, the discussion has... So I remember about 10 years ago, a lot of people thought, seemed to be kind of generally accepted that you can't absorb more than... Sometimes the number was as low as 20. Sometimes it was as high as 50 grams of protein in a meal. And so therefore, if you eat more than that in one meal, it's just going to be turned into glucose and it's just going to be eliminated. And that's it. And then it seemed to shift maybe after a couple of years of the evidence-based fitness space gaining traction. There was a shift to, well, you can absorb more than that. We don't really know how much. So don't worry about it too much. And then more recently, and then I'm going to shut up, what I've seen is that it's maybe more generally acknowledged that absorption limits are high. Don't even worry about that. However, if you want to optimize your results, and that's a word that is kind of fuzzy, it's vague, but if you want to optimize your results, it's best to eat 4 to 5 servings of about the same amount of protein, call it 30 to 50 grams of protein throughout the day, spaced out by a few hours. And there are different reasons for that. And I've even, I've told people that based on my understanding of different literature. And so I just wanted to give that as some context for this discussion, because I know that's where a lot of listeners are at.
Sure.
So I'm going to pass the torch.
Sure. Yeah. I think, you know, you've given a, there's that kind of the brief history of protein, probably not as brief, maybe that's about 15 years worth of understanding. I think there's a few points to sort of hit on. First, to your point around how much can we absorb? And that was the question a lot of people asked, with maybe the misunderstanding that you can absorb a lot of protein, and by a lot, a lot, you know, hundreds of grams. That's really not the rate limiting step in any of this, particularly if you're young and healthy. The key question is, how much can your body use of what you absorb? And I think that's the 20 to 30 grams, you know, that per meal. And a lot of that comes from work that our lab has done, and others, kind of showing that the response of, say, protein synthesis in muscle, which is, you know, the making of new muscle, plateaus at a certain point. It's what we call dose saturable or whatever. And so then people were like, well, you can only digest it. I'm like, no, back up. You can digest a lot. It's how much you can use. And that's obviously a nuanced answer to, you know, the point that bigger people could probably store more and use more protein than smaller people. So it's not an absolute amount. I mean, every protein requirement we always give is divided by per kilogram of body weight, so or per pound of body weight. So let's just say, with regards to your statement, yeah, I agree. Daily protein intake is the number one variable.
twice the RDA, so 1.6 grams per kilo or about 0.7 grams per pound, you're going to get a lot of the benefit. That's definitely, you know, a lot more than the minimum, which is the RDA or a 0.8 or about 0.3 grams per pound. And that's number one. And the subtlety is, you know, how much should I sit down and eat at a meal? And I'd have been one of the people that would have told you, just like you said, you know, 30 grams, maybe 40 each meal. First meal of the day, pretty important. Second meal of the day, probably okay. Last meal of the day, depending on how close it is to bedtime, maybe that's a pretty big meal as well. And you can probably squeeze in one more, I call it feeding occasion. So let's say, you know, a snack, mid-afternoon snack, late-night snack, something like that. And then there was things like, you know, maybe eat something closer to the time you go to bed. And then, you know, things changed quite drastically recently with a, you know, it was a good friend of mine, Jorn Trommelin. I was actually Jorn's external examiner for his PhD. So I guess I'm partially responsible for unleashing him on the world. He works with a good friend of mine, Luc Van Loon, over in the Netherlands, and he just published a study that I think caused a lot of people to go, oh, hold on, this is different than we've heard and that we've understood. So, you know, without, you know, diving too deep into the details, let's just say that they had conditions where they gave people no protein, 25 grams of protein, or 100 grams of protein, which is an pretty substantial amount of protein. And they found that actually the 100 gram response was higher in terms of what it did for muscle than the 25 gram response. And it was sustained over a very long period of time. So, you know, that sort of bucks the, I guess, answer that I would have given prior to that paper, that it's kind of capped out at around 25, 30 grams and that you can definitely digest. Takes a long time, longer, use more protein.
I would love to get into some of the details of this paper that I think will help people understand what you just said and put it into context of other things, especially people who spend a bit of time doing desk research themselves. They're probably thinking to some of the research we've alluded to, some of the research on intermittent fasting that has indicated that, yes, you can absolutely gain muscle and strength if you restrict yourself to just maybe two feedings of protein per day. But if you're trying to maximize muscle and strength gain, so let's say you're a natural weightlifter, you're an experienced weightlifter, it's already hard enough to gain muscle and strength as it is, and you're trying to gain every little edge you can, that IF is probably not going to be the best choice for you, that more frequent feedings. And so in this study, so we had this 100 gram feeding of protein. How did those results compare? It's probably not surprising in some respects that it beat out 25 grams, but you mentioned that it takes longer to digest. So are we looking at a cumulative effect over time? And what are your thoughts on how that might compare to taking that 100 grams of protein and splitting it up into a few different feedings?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that paper, one takeaway is that we can digest 100 grams. So to the point of, you know, you can digest a lot, that's a pretty big, I think, thing that people go, oh, wow, I never knew, you know, but that we knew that for some time. So the digestion is not an issue. It does take longer. Definitely the smaller dose is much more easily digested. Need to be clear on a couple of things. It's not real food. It was just milk protein. So it's a contrived sort of circumstance, but, you know, we'll gloss over that for now. Let's just say that, you know, dividing it up would have been how I would recommend things. And, you know, but when you divide the doses, still the 100 grams begins to come out on top. The differences are small, I would call them. And I definitely think what people need to take away is that, you know, the primary driver of, you know, accumulating new muscle is definitely the weightlifting. Let's be clear on that. And the protein is the glaze on the cake, or the icing on the cake, or the sprinkles on the icing. I'm not really sure what, but it adds, I'll call it the finishing touch, if you like. From that standpoint, then, it really does appear, to your point, that this sort of intermittent fasting or OMAD, like one meal a day type eating, is not as, I'll call it, you know, detrimental for your gains as we once thought. And I would have been one person who would have said, you know, if you had to pick, like, I'm not opposed to intermittent fasting, if that's your thing, and definitely very good for body composition. I'd have said, but I don't know that it's the right way to optimize muscle mass gains. This paper has changed my mind on that. And I think that, you know, a lot of people go, oh, you were wrong. And I was like, yeah, man, I've been wrong a lot in my career as a scientist, but that's how science works, right? You have a theory and you have some data until something comes along and supersedes it.
Lest you turn into David Lustig or other people.
Well, or, you know, or other people. Yeah, no, it's a good example.
But I mean, not you.
Yeah, no, fair. But yeah, the dogmatic belief is fine, but in the face of evidence to the contrary, you can't, I don't think anyway, call yourself a scientist and say, oh, I just don't believe that. I mean, like, you know what? You know, you just have to, and to try and integrate it. So, you know, I think that there's a one big lesson that came, and it's that, you know, this sort of meal timing that I've talked about, or lots of others have talked about throughout the day, is probably less important than we once said for, you know, conditioning and gaining muscle. It's a short-term study. It was a study that's done over hours, like basically a day, not the sort of time frame that it takes to gain muscle. So that's where I say to people, interest, like, amazing study. I don't know that there's another lab in the world that could pull this off, and these guys did it. Just take it for what it is. It's an acute response, which, you know, we've done lots of as well, so I'm not dismissing it, but take it for what it is there's sometimes a disconnect between that type of study and what actually happens to muscle in the long run. But I'm one that's a little bit more comfortable saying that people say, oh, I eat one meal a day, that's what I do. And I'm like, okay, you know, and to your point, empirically, we know that those people can get stronger, they can gain muscle, they can certainly, they get very lean if they're adhering to it. So yeah, that's the good news, the takeaway from that study for sure.
And so if I'm hearing you correctly, this study may not overturn it's a small body of evidence, but it still is a body of evidence nonetheless that does suggest that, or at least that has supported the position that multiple feedings throughout the day is probably best for optimizing muscle and strength gain. Am I right? Or are you even rethinking, like, you know, actually, maybe that's not the case. And if that's the case, I'd love to hear maybe just some of your thoughts as to why that has been suggested. There is evidence to support that. And at least there are a handful of papers I can think of that I've read that you know, seem to make a good case for that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of it to do with the protein is that, I mean, you know, everything has evolved. If you're a fish or a bird or a mammal, you always have a mechanism to take nitrogen off of an amino acid and turn it into something. If you're a fish, you make ammonia. You make uric acid if you're a bird, and we make urea. And every, you know, organism has a mechanism for that. So we've always said you've got to use the amino acids, the protein, when it's ingested. Or it's useless or used less. I would still think that that's partially true anyway. But what this paper showed is that even if you took a huge meal, so 100 grams of protein, and again, it's milk protein, so it's a little different than food, an egg or meat or chicken or something like that. So we still don't know the answer to the question if it's a meal. But I would say that the small meals still fit within the scheme. I think what this adds is that it doesn't need to be small meals. It can be one big meal, and there probably is far less of a difference between those than we once thought. So I'm not saying that the multiple feedings per day is bad, or I don't think it's worse than, even though statistically in the study they showed it was slightly lower. I don't think that those differences are overly meaningful. But it's, you know, maybe, so maybe you can worry less about, oh, I missed my feed at this time. I didn't have this, you know, can I make up for it at a subsequent meal? And then I'm like, oh, I'm pressed for time. Actually, like, I've really got this one meal that I'm going to make count. And this paper would say, you know what? It's probably far less of an issue than we once thought, in that one meal is going to do the job.
Another practical use case here is vacation, or if you're traveling and you're not going to eat 4 to 6, 20, 30 gram servings of protein per day. It's not going to happen.
No.
And so if you can only get in, I mean, I'm 190 pounds. So if it's only a few days, if I could just get one meal of 100 grams of protein, I mean, I'm fine. I'm fine for if I were to do that every day on average and train really hard, not quite optimal, but it's nice to know that, again, a vacation is just a perfect example where I tend to not eat much in the mornings, and because I know there's always going to be dinners. And so maybe lunch is just that kind of protein meal, get that out of the way so I can just enjoy dinner, and that's feasible. And then, as you said, just in day-to-day living, we get busy and, okay, you missed a meal, it's not a big deal. Oh, you missed two meals even, it's not a big deal, you can make it up. But I wanted to ask about this food point. You've added that caveat a couple of times. People might be wondering, why might that change things? Why might a mixed meal, which is typically how people are eating most of their protein, why might that produce a different outcome?
Yeah. So first, I think the important point with saying about milk protein is milk is a mixture of two proteins, whey, which I think most people have heard of because it's the supplement that they take, and casein. Casein is a slowly digested protein. So that is 80% of the milk protein that these guys fed in this study. And so it's this sort of, and the classic is that whey gives up its amino acids fast, and then it sort of slowly trickles off. Whereas casein is a slow digested protein, and it's, you know, just the amino acids appear slower. So I think that that's an important point, is that you're eating 100 grams. So 80 grams of that meal is a slow digested protein. That's casein. Meals, when you eat them and you have, you know, generally, let's say a sandwich. So there's two pieces of, you know, if you're okay eating carbohydrates, it's there's two pieces of, I always have to, I never used to think about it that people go, I just don't eat carbs. So I'm like, okay, well, so we're going to go
That's a big life mistake, but okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was like, whatever. I was like, well, we're going to go with what we usually call a sandwich. So there's two pieces of bread or maybe two pieces of lettuce. Not the lettuce or two patties and a chicken breast in the middle. That's not a sandwich. That's just a triple decker in my book, you know? So two pieces of bread and, you know, the meat in between. Those are also digested slowly, but the rates of appearance of the amino acids are sort of far less predictable. They sort of do this kind of thing, and then they peak and they come down. That's what mixed meals look like. And so that's a different rate of appearance of the building blocks of muscle and other protein-containing tissues, which could change the answer to the question. So I think that it's just important to appreciate that still awesome research, but it's milk protein. That's a pretty specific type of protein, and it may be a little bit different with meals. I have no reason to suspect that it's wildly different.
Sure.
But I can't give you the exact answer. In my heart of hearts, I want to say is that they're probably not overly dissimilar. But look, you know, a year or two from now, I would fully expect that some of these questions might be answered. But you'll have to stay tuned on that one.
At least some people listening probably have heard that your body's muscle building machinery, so to speak, can only work so so quickly. It only has so much capacity for muscle protein synthesis. And they've probably heard that somewhere around, I know it might seem like I'm moving backward here, but I'm not. I'll get to the the new question. They've probably heard that 50-ish grams or so seems to bring it to, you know, max RPMs, so to speak, that appears to elevate muscle protein synthesis rates as high as they're going to go. And then they've probably also heard that muscle protein synthesis rates only remain elevated for so long in response to one feeding. And so these are some of the points that kind of some of the building blocks of that argument for more frequent feedings. And so what in this study was revelatory in terms of that model? Because for this study's findings to be true, then there was something mechanistically that was missing, or there was a misunderstanding of some kind.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, previously, and I think this is pretty well established, that when you eat food, amino acids go up in your bloodstream, protein synthesis goes up, but then protein synthesis shuts off. And, you know, to your point is that even in the face of sustained amino acids, we just don't continue to make more and more protein. When you perform resistance exercise, your muscle is sensitized to the effects of protein being around. It just becomes much more sort of, I call it much more sponge-like in sort of taking out protein. I think the biggest thing that this study shows is that actually that shut-off mechanism is kind of removed. It's so that the response is still long-lasting. And in concordance then with elevated amino acids as well. So it doesn't shut off. It just keeps going. I mean, one of the things that I do point out when I say to people, they're like, well, so more and more protein begets more. And the title of the paper, which I think was a bit of an overstatement, there is no upper limit to anabolism, is incorrect. I mean, the implications...
It makes for good headlines.
It's great. It's great headline. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, if that were true, then eating more and more and more and more would make you more and more and bigger.
I wish.
Yeah.
We would just eat 500 grams of protein a day and we would cut our weightlifting in half and we would just, you know, that's all you gotta do.
Yeah. Hook myself up to an intravenous feed and eat and just like I'd grow forever. And so clearly the mechanisms to be able to deaminate amino acids and get rid of the stuff that you're eating would upregulate or we'd die. But we just don't keep putting on muscle ad infinitum based on how much protein we eat. So that's the practical part of it. But that shutoff mechanism in response to amino acids is clearly overridden by the exercise itself. So I think that that's an important message that came out of the paper for sure.
And for people wondering specifically, are you referring to post-workout, which is also something I wanted to get to, so maybe that's a good segue, or are you just referring to somebody who just generally resistance trains, or is this more of a timing thing?
Yeah, so one thing that we do know is that if you're untrained, you're fairly novice, you do a resistance bout, and that sort of that big sensitization, that anabolic window, we call it, or people call it, is open for a long time, probably like a couple of days. The more trained you get, the window gets a little bit shorter. It's still, you know, if you're doing a pretty intense resistance workout, it's probably 12 hours or so. So it's not, you don't have to have the protein immediately post-workout. So we say, you know, somewhere around the workout, when you've got amino acids there, your muscle's going to make use of them. I still favor post-exercise because, I mean, personally, I'll just say this is that, I mean, I'm much more receptive to drinking and having something in my stomach after than before.
Yep, same. You know.
So that's the time when we talk about, you know, reconditioning and repairing and remodeling and all of the things that go along with protein. So I'll just say it's generic to sort of generally working out, but the post-exercise period is what we're talking about here. And, you know, elevated amino acids, protein synthesis just keeps hammering on.
Hey there, if you are hearing this, you are still listening,
which is awesome. Thank you. And if you are enjoying this podcast, or if you just like my podcast in general and you are getting at least something out of it, would you mind sharing it with a friend or a loved one or a not so loved one even who might want to learn something new? Word of mouth helps really bigly in growing the show, so if you think of someone who might like this episode or another one, please do tell them about it.
And just to point up this this anabolic window, which that concept it used to imply that if you wait too long, the window closes and it's too late. And of course, that's not true. To your point, even in an experienced weightlifter, you're still, I think you said 12 hours or so, you're still looking at a 12-hour window where your body has a heightened response to protein. And so practically speaking, that's the entire day's worth of protein, probably, if somebody's training first thing in the morning, you know.
You would hope so. 12 hours is a long time. And it's, again, it's sort of, you know, like I still see, and it's predominantly the guys with a shaker in the gym, and it's like, you know, slamming it. And I'm not saying that's a poor practice, because—
Either that or it's BCAAs.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like, it's sort of like that's water on top of a bucket of water, but whatever.
Tasty water. What do you mean?
Yeah, sure. Go for it. But the, you know, the bottom line to me is, you know, if you don't have that, or if you're like, oh shit, I've got to do this, I've got to run, don't sweat it. Like, you're still going to be able to make use of it. And I don't know if it's 12 hours, like it could be 16,
but it's not one or 30 minutes.
Like the window opens and then 3 hours later, it's like shut and you've missed the opportunity. That window is, I talk about this so much. There's a paper out there that some colleagues and friends of mine have written, and they talk about the post-exercise garage door. Like, it's wide, it's long, you know, it's big. And that's probably a more apt analogy than the window that's transiently open that shuts. It's not how things are working.
And just to make it clear for listeners, I haven't heard anything that suggests that eating a large amount of protein after training. Most people, I think it just becomes kind of a habit where you're gonna probably eat a meal within a couple of hours of working out. Typically, that's how it is for most people. Changing that from, let's say, currently that meal is 30 grams of protein, or maybe it's 50. That making it 100 grams is not going to be better or worse. There isn't a particular reason, it sounds like, to rejigger your meal plan to provide 100 grams of protein after training rather than maybe 30, and then a few hours later another 30, and so forth.
Yeah, to be absolutely, you know, crystal clear on this point, within the paper itself, there was a statistically significantly greater anabolic response with the large meal. So, you know, I don't want to dismiss statistical significance, which,
sure,
you know, sometimes I live and die by. The point, again, is to say that's the acute effect. And so I'm going to gloss over that and say that that's far less important than I need to get 100 versus I'm going to do the multiple smaller meals, which I still think is fine. And yes, so to your, the short answer to your question is it's not an issue. So if you want to eat like that, no problem, but certainly don't go, oh, like this 30, 40 gram meal or whatever, that's just useless. Now I need to get 100. It's not a good idea.
Yeah.
In my opinion, unless that's what you want to do, because everybody goes, actually, I have no issues with that. Like, it's what I do, you know, at least 2 or 3 days a week. And I get it. Timing, convenience, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think you're giving anything up is the big deal in doing that. So that's one thing that, you know, to come back to it, is that we've learned from this study is this, that not to worry so much about, oh, I'm missing the opportunity, I didn't have my, you know, slam the protein shake if that's what you've got, or get a big meal in, or you know, and you're going to be okay. Like it's still, you're turning the gears and you're getting the benefit back for sure.
Some people, might diet hackers maybe might think, this makes me think of, there was a trend of very, very low fat dieting with the thought of, well, de novo lipogenesis, it occurs, you know, you have to eat so much carbohydrate really to gain fat. So why don't I bring my dietary fat down to nothing and eat nothing but protein and carbs? And, it didn't work. Some people might, I mean, I think it's actually a valid question to ask, say, okay, so I train and I have a period of, heightened sensitivity to protein, and that off switch is jammed. It's just on basically. And so would it not be beneficial? So let's say currently I train, and then by the time that garage door closes, I've eaten my final, that's my final 100 grams of protein for the day, or maybe it's my final 75 or something like that. Should I play around with my meal plan so I can eat a lot of protein in the, let's just even say in the 6 hours or maybe 10 hours that follows training? Should I try to eat 200 grams of protein or 300 grams of protein?
Yeah. Yeah.
I could see somebody thinking like, wow,
sure.
I mean,
sure.
If I'm just going to, if I can just maximize muscle protein synthesis and my body doesn't know how to stop, what if I protein overfeed after I train?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing is, there probably is an upper limit to digestion. We may not have found it. Clearly, 100 grams.
I'll just drink whey. I'm going to drink.
Yeah, yeah.
Just get a whole bottle.
At some point, I think you're going to find that doesn't happen, as you can't absorb it all. But let's say you could. Like I said, you know, practically speaking, you've only got so much muscle, and even if the off switch is jammed, and it's like I'm just going to keep making. You keep doing that, your body will upregulate all of the systems to make urea, to oxidize amino acids. Like it's an impossible scenario to sustain. So what happens, and we've known this for probably about 60 years, is that, and some pretty well done experiments to say, if you gave people big meals, then on the other side, when they weren't eating, they went into a big catabolic state. They basically compensated on the other side. So then people say, oh, I'll just keep eating. And so that was the sort of...
That's where the BCAAs come in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just never stop, right? all you do is that everything that disposes of amino acids, all of those mechanisms get massively upregulated. And then you're just you're a metabolic burner and disposer of amino acids par excellence, or you know, you'd run into health issues. So let's just say that you can try it. I doubt that it'll give you more than what you're getting. And to take people back to, I like to use the bake the cake analogy, right? Listing the weights and doing it regularly bakes the cake. You want to ice the cake, that's the protein. You can put a thick layer of icing on when you're a novice, and the more trained you get, the icing gets thinner. So just remember where we're playing when we're talking about some of these variables, is that people believe it's an unlock to muscle gains beyond. And I'm like, that's, you're doing that by lifting the weights. The protein is the glaze on top, or the cream on the glaze, or something like that. It's not the be all and end all. Going to the gym, doing it regularly, caloric surplus probably if you want to gain, and then the protein, and then all of the other nuances are underneath that. And when I say protein, I mean like daily protein intake.
Absolutely. Does any of this change, any of the stuff we've been discussing, with age as we get older?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I've gotten older, I could tell you no personally. But yes, probably it does. You know, it's one thing that we know as you get older, the capacity to be anabolic is diminished. We call it anabolic resistance. It shares some parallels, I'm sure, with insulin resistance. You just don't, you're not as sensitive to the
the stimulus of insulin. In this case, you're not as sensitive to the stimulus of lifting weights, for starters, protein, number two. And then the two combined, you just don't do as great a job as you did when you were the younger version of you. Everybody wants to know where it starts. I'd like to be able to tell you it starts at around age 57. That's just a personal observation. But I have no idea. I don't do as much. I don't lift as heavy. I don't lift the type of volume I did when I was 20. So maybe that's probably part of it, because it hurts. So, you know, all bets are off when we talk about aging, but, you know, the dial eventually is getting turned down. And the only thing you can do is to choose to age sort of in this slow, gradual fashion, as opposed to this and weightlifting, resistance exercise, any higher protein diet are the two, I think, two key parts of trying to sustain that. But yeah, you're never going to get back and look, be able to do all the things you did in your 20s, right? I got that just ridiculous amount of time in the gym when I was in my 20s. So.
What else was there to do?
I don't know. I don't know. And you thought that when you did it, you were like, I'm busy. And I'm like hell, you were. But yeah, so
it's 1 a.m. and you've been in the gym for 3 hours.
I know. Yeah, like, if I had a message from my 20-year-old self, it was like, first, you're not busy. Second, you can probably get that workout done in a lot less time. And third, all the people that you thought you were meeting in the gym, you know, blah, 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 all those things. I mean, it's just, but yeah, no, aging, I wish we could, you know, I could tell you there's something we could turn it back.
You mean we can't just take NMN and reverse our biological age?
Still nothing, nothing in a pill. Maybe slow things down, but nothing in a pill is going to, you know, turn it back or, you know, reverse age or anything else like that. So exercise is number one. Good diet, have some friends, you know, live well, yada, yada.
And as for protein intake, is there anything, though, that ideally you would change? Like you mentioned, a higher protein diet. So as we get older, should we still be thinking with, for example, 0.7 grams per pound per day? No reason to go above that. Anything with individual feedings or distribution or?
Yeah, that number I think is universal. There's nothing that's out there that makes me think that you're getting more. I just don't see the difference. Like a lot of people, I stick at this sort of lower end, even though it's higher than what's recommended. And a lot of people are like, oh, you should go up to this. And I'm like, you know, if that's your thing, like, I'm not telling you not to do it. But what I am telling you is that there's nothing, and I mean 0.0 evidence that we have that 1.6 versus 0.7 versus 2.2 grams per kilo or 1 gram per pound, that this is better than this. So, you know, there's no study out there that shows it. There's a couple that are trying, no difference. So, you know, you make your mind up. I mean, I think that the quality of the protein may begin to matter, but if you're still active and lifting and doing all the things that I'm telling you to do as you get older, that's a far bigger stimulus to keep yourself anabolically sensitive than to keep trying to pour protein on top. But it's still, remember, it's still two times what we're recommending. And so there'd be another camp of people that would be looking at me like I have two heads and say, that's an enormous amount of protein. And, you know, I spent enough time on social media to run into those people as well. And I'm like, well, that's the protein intake of 95% of college age males on campus. Like, they easily meet that, no problem. So you can call it enormous. And I'm like, well, I got 33,000 undergrads, about half of which are men. And they're hitting that like without a thought. So you can call it enormous. I just don't think it is.
Even women who, in my experience, when they start lifting weights and start learning about this stuff, typically are eating less protein than the average guy, in my experience. And so there's a short period of adjustment where they go, wow, I'm supposed to eat 80 grams of protein per day. I'm eating 30 right now. And then so there's initially it can feel like a lot, although I also have heard from many of them over the years who like how much fuller they feel. And then they quickly get used to it and they go, oh, okay. So if I just make sure that I start my day with a nice serving of protein, that's pretty easy. Then I just have to get in a couple more. But if I'm only at 15 grams of protein by dinner, then that's when it's more difficult.
Yeah, that you know, you hit on a key point. I think it probably is, I'll call it underappreciated. Every single study that's been done, like the one we talked about, the Trollen paper, and the ones that we've done and lots of other labs, and you know, there's not too many of us that do these types of studies. We bring people in after an overnight fast, and then we feed them. So it's a first meal effect in about, I'd say about 90 to 95% of the work that's out there. So if that first meal is, you know, AM breakfast, fair enough. But just, that's an important point to remember, because I think that meal is, like, you know, the most important meal of the day. It doesn't have to be breakfast, but whatever your first meal is and you break your fast, then that needs to be I'll call it a patterning meal or something that sort of sets the tone for the rest of the day. So it should be higher in protein. And to your point, Mike, I think that this is, you know, a lot of people out there, they do, you know, that's their smallest protein meal. And so if that's very carb rich and very high in fiber, as you know, if you're following the heart healthy guidelines, it supposedly should be. Then lunch is maybe sort of an edge up, and then dinner is this big meal. And sometimes it is tougher to make up, but I think so thinking more about protein containing foods, so Greek style yogurt, skyr, it's okay to have an egg. You know, we've taken them off the dirt list. They're okay for you at that first meal, and to really sort of kickstart the response. And I think that's something that most people just sort of, you know, maybe haven't realized with a lot of the work. But a good friend of mine, Don Lehman, he emphasizes this all the time. It's a first meal effect. And that's an important point, I think, for your listeners for sure.
And just to follow up on that, is that mostly just, you mentioned a patterning effect where it kind of sets the tone. Okay, we've started with some protein, and then now we're already maybe one third to our goal for the day or something. Or are there some physiological reasons you say that?
Yeah, I wish I could give you some great, you know, insightful physiology answer. But all I can tell you is that when we look at all of the studies that have always been done, and it's just a control issue to say this, that we start people fasted, and then they work out, and we feed them, or we feed them, then they work out. It's just a much, I'll call it, cleaner experimental model to do it that way. So that's how we've done it. But when we do the subsequent feeding, we do have some data that's in process right now, which will show that it's probably far less important than that first meal effect, if you like. I can't really explain it other than it's the time when your muscle is sort of, you know, it's been without food and nutrients for some period of time, and that enhances to a degree some of the sensitivity that it's going to, you know, respond to. So the second effect is like, well, you know, we've seen that stuff before. Like, we're not as responsive as we were. Working out definitely takes some of the breaks off of that, but I think that first meal is key and pretty critical in the response.
Interesting. You mentioned quality of protein. Can you speak quickly to that? Just because that's also an ongoing. I thought the incomplete protein myth finally died. It has not. It's still very alive.
It has. It's dead. It's pretty much dead. Like you know, vegan versus you know, meat and everything, and it's just a preference issue and whatever your schema for. I'm an omnivore, so I'll just, you know, cop to that. I see the merits in both ways of eating. You do whatever you want to do. My point is, when you get to about 1.6 grams per kilo per day, or, you know, 0.7 grams per pound, that issue becomes a completely moot point. And lots of people on all kinds of social media platforms say, but plant proteins are deficient. Like, no, plant proteins are not deficient. They might be lower, but they're not deficient.
And when we eat, you know, complementary proteins and we sort of, you know, eat mixed meals, which is what most people do, then it becomes a non-issue very, very quickly. There might be some sort of small, and when I say small, like really in the margin type stuff, sort of, you know, the statistical difference between the 100 gram and the 25 gram. And I'm thinking, you know, that's not something that we all need to sort of run away and say plant proteins are inferior to. Everything that we've done where we compare the two of them head to head, and lots of other work from not just our lab, but Luc Van Loon's lab is another great one for doing this. The differences become very, very small. As you get older, it might become a bigger issue. But I still think then that the main driver and the thing that you can do to sort of make that kind of a non-issue is to lift some weights and be physically active. And then things become very, inconsequential as far as the way that you're going to gain muscle.
To that point of as you get older, it may or may not matter. The way that most people eat, most people are omnivores as well. And so probably the majority of the protein is going to come from, I mean, at least 50% is going to come from animal products, whether it's meat or dairy or whatever. And then there's a lot of kind of complementary or supplementary protein, so to speak, that you can get in beans and legumes and seeds and other things. And so if I'm hearing you right, then that a person who's eating that way has no reason, regardless of age, to force themselves to maybe eat even more animal protein when they actually like the way they're eating right now. They don't want to have to eat more animal products. And then also, if you have somebody who's vegetarian, the same would go for them. Is that that's under the assumption that they are getting to the right amount of protein? And if they are doing that, they're probably being deliberate about some of the foods they're eating, because it is kind of hard to do if you just randomly eat yummy plant foods. There's probably some fish in there or some tofu or tempeh, or they'd put some thought into it. And then for a vegan eater, that would that has to happen, or you don't get very far if you don't put a little bit of thought into your meal plan to get enough protein.
Yeah, well, so you hit all the concepts that I think are important. First is the total amount of food, and I think that this is some of the harder part. I think for, you know, as people get older, their appetite goes down. They tend not to eat as much. If you're vegan, you need to be a bit judicious about how you pick your foods, and so you can't just sort of, you know, think, oh, it's inconsequential.
I saw some woman on YouTube. She eats 100 bananas a day.
Okay.
But does she? Does she? Are you sure?
Yeah.
Or does she just say she does?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to be too skeptical, but that sounds a bit of a stretch. I mean, you can. It's about you can be a crummy omnivore and not eat the right foods, just like you can be a crummy vegetarian and a crummy vegan, right? Like you can. You know, a can of Diet Coke and a slice of Wonder Bread is still a vegan diet, but it's not good nutrition. So most vegans and or vegetarians that I have interacted with, and particularly those that are athletic, they're very careful about how they plan their diets. Not all, but most, and they have a pretty good working knowledge of what they might be quote unquote deficient in. But the arguments that I hear a lot on social media about, you're eating plants, they're poison, they've got poisons in them.
That's even worse. I hate it so much.
First, that's terrible. And then they go, and it's deficient. And I'm like, no, it's not. They're like, well, it's low in. And I'm like, but then you eat more. And they're like, but yeah, you're not getting nutrients. And I'm like, okay, we're done. Like it's, but.
The plants are trying to kill you. Why would you eat them? They're trying to kill you.
Well, it becomes I mean, it takes on, forgive me, but almost sort of religious overtones in the way that you eat. And I think, you know, the people that are talking like that have just lost the plot a little bit about, you know, what food is all about, besides the fact that it's nutrition. Should also be enjoyed. And if you enjoy eating that way, then who am I to tell you to do something different?
Well, I know we are coming up on time, so I don't want to run over. And that went by quickly. That was a great discussion. Touched on all the key points I wanted to ask you about. So why don't we quickly wrap up with? Well, first, let me just ask. I know there's a few more minutes. So is there anything that I should have asked? Anything else you'd like to say that you didn't get to say yet?
I don't think so. I still, when people ask me about a lot about nutrition, I'm like. And people get upset when I say this. I'm like, I think it's a pretty, I'll call it from a health standpoint, a distant number two to being physically active. Like once you dial the physical activity and particularly the strength training, resistance training in, a lot of things fall in place. The nutrition, not that it's unimportant, but for mere mortals, and I put myself very much in that category and not in this sort of, I'm trying to squeeze out the last drop of juice. But you know, if you are in that part of the thing, then some of what I'm talking about, what we're talking about is a bigger deal. But for most folks, get to the gym and do it regularly. And then the eating part is the, you know, that's discipline number two in my mind. But protein, once you get to the total amount, all the rest becomes sort of, I'll call them sub details underneath that total amount, if you like, rule.
That's a great point on the exercise. It reminds me of just a point I've made. I've written about it. I've spoken about it, referencing some research and basically saying, hey, based on my understanding here, exercise is the most important thing. And it looks like if you exercise regularly and you maintain a healthy body composition, and that's a range, you don't have to be shredded, but maintain a healthy body composition, that will negate, it appears, a lot of the negative effects associated with a poor diet. I'm not saying to eat a poor diet. It's better to do it all. But to your point, first and foremost, you have to stay active. And it's interesting having discussions with people where some people are looking for the magic pill. That's one level of fantasy. And then there are people who are, okay, they've accepted there is no magic pill, but they're looking for the magic diet, the magic food. And in those discussions I've had, I've tried to explain this point of, well, we could talk about diet, but you're not exercising at all. And really what you need to be doing is exercising. And so I actually don't care. Let's not do too many things at once. Eat the way you're eating. Let's not change any of that. And let's just get you exercising. And there's resistance there because that's harder to do than, can I just make some little inconsequential change to my, yeah. Can I start eating a Brazil nut every day? Can't that fix all of my problems? Like, what do you mean? So, anyway,
I agree 100%. No, you're spot on. You're spot on. I'm a big believer too, that, you know, if you don't have the physical activity dialed in, not that changing your eating habits is a poor idea. I just don't think that you're, and everybody then wants to talk about weight loss. And I'm like, yeah, so beyond this sort of, and not to be too myopic on weight loss as the, and not just a part of healthy living, I think that being physically active is like hands down is the number one activity that you can do for your health and your, I don't know, dare I say longevity or health span, but you know, you get my point. I think we're both drinking the Kool-Aid. So
Non-negotiable. Right. Okay. Well, anyways, this was a great discussion. Why don't we just wrap up quickly with where people can find you if they want to check out some of your work, some of your research, anything in particular you want them to know?
Sure. Yeah, I'm on Twitter, X, whatever it is these days. I'm on Instagram. I'm on TikTok. I'm really on TikTok just to really piss my son off, my youngest son, who said old people ruin TikTok. So. As an
You're
old
doing
person.
Your part. You're fighting a good fight, actually.
I am ruining the platform for people like my son. I am MackinProf, MackinProf. I'm on LinkedIn and Facebook as well. So I think that sort of covers it. I'm really bad at TikTok. I'm okay at Instagram. I kind of do my best work on X, I think. So
I like X the most, too. Because it's a text-first platform, which is, I like writing stuff, so...
Yeah, and you know, I'll be honest. I've perused TikTok, and it I find it shocking. So
it's brain damaging. I downloaded it, and then I signed up, and then I uninstalled it in the same day, and that was the end of it.
I'm on it, and I'm on it basically because a lot of my students that I mentor, they say, "Oh, I got this off of TikTok," and I just, yeah.
All right. Well, I know you have to run, so I want to thank you again for your time.
My pleasure, Mike. Thanks very much for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you liked this episode. I hope you found it helpful. And if you did, subscribe to the show because it makes sure that you don't miss new episodes. And it also helps me because it increases the rankings of the show a little bit, which of course then makes it a little bit more easily found by other people who may like it just as much as you. And if you didn't like something about this episode or about the show in general, or if you have ideas or suggestions or just feedback to share, shoot me an email, mike@muscleforlife.com, muscleforlife.com, and let me know what I could do better or just what your thoughts are about maybe what you'd like to see me do in the future. I read everything myself. I'm always looking for new ideas and constructive feedback. So thanks again for listening to this episode, and I hope to hear from you soon.